Bride, can you hear me?
I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. That's what I was just making sure, because I just sent the death ray out, which mutes everybody else's line, but I want to make sure we could hear you. So, welcome everybody to the International Citizens Climate Lobby call. Commander McBride, who you're talking to, is 35 groups throughout the U.S. and Canada, all of whom have a very big commitment to solving what's happening with the climate. There's three things that we do every month, the first of which is we attempt to broaden our knowledge, our education on the subject of the climate. So we've had a lot of scientists, we've had economists, we've had messaging experts, we've had politicians. We've wanted someone from the military for a long time, so we're really, really happy that you could be on. There's two other things we do every month, though. Every single month we practice speaking about the issue. We take the perspective that if we're not communicating with people, if we're not reaching people, if we're not bringing them along, it's not because of something with them, but it's rather that we have not worked on ourselves enough on being able to reach a wide variety of audiences. So every single month, after the educational portion of the call, we practice speaking. And then the third thing we do is every single month we take action. You know, one of the things our founder and president, Marshall Saunders, says all the time is there's a big difference between complaining about something and doing something. And the people on this call are people who every single month they take action in a commitment to resolve what's happening with the climate. In fact, working around Marshall in our office, our founder, it's gotten kind of dangerous to complain about anything, because anytime you complain about something, he wants to know what you're going to do about it. So I pretty much stopped complaining at the office entirely. But the important thing to know about the people who you're speaking with today are these are people who understand that we need to take action to solve this, and it's not just something that is a one-time action, but is something where every single month they need to be in action, generating sufficient political will so it's easier for politicians to move on the issue. Okay, so we want to get to what your area of expertise in the climate in just a moment here. You know, I have read quite a bit of comments from Admiral Mullen, the head of the Joint Chiefs, regarding energy in the military, which is not what you're going to talk about. You know, I've read articles that talk about there's metrics that he has that shows how many troops we lose for every mile that we transport fossil fuels, and that the military has a big interest in renewable energy because of that. But again, your area, as I understand, and I just want to make sure and validate with you, is the area of the climate, and that the task force you're a part of really has three priorities: the Arctic, sea level rise, and climate change as it relates to geopolitical issues. So first of all, do I have those three priorities correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, great. And your particular area is the area of the Arctic, which I'll ask you to speak about in just a moment. So let me just tell everybody, Commander McBride is a Naval Meteorology and Oceanography Officer and has served as the Executive Officer of the U.S. National Naval Ice Center in Sweetland, Maryland. He also serves as a meteorology and oceanography officer on the amphibious assault ship USS Bonham Richard, completing two deployments during Operations Enduring Freedom and Iraqi Freedom. He holds undergraduate and postgraduate degrees in physics, meteorology, and physical oceanography, hydrographic science, and national security and strategic studies. So again, we are really, really happy to have you on the call, and could you just tell a little bit about some of the things that you see as priorities in the Arctic, and not just in terms of the science, but how that relates to what the Navy will be doing up there?
Well, first of all, the Navy recognizes that the climate is changing. Sometimes this is referred to as that stationarity is dead, because when you look at what the climate's going to be next year, it's an average of what the climate has been over the past year, because that is assumed to be static or unchanging. But the problem is that the future forecasts for climate are going to adjust, so that it's not stationary anymore. So the Navy recognizes that this is changing and humans are a part of the cause. Our near-term focus is on the Arctic because of the thermodynamic properties of the Earth's system, the polar regions see the heating more quickly, and there's also fewer people up there, fewer sensors, and much less is understood about the nature of the Arctic climate. And it's an ocean, and we're a Navy, so we have the primary interest in that region. The one of the things we say is that the Arctic is an ocean. It's changing, but it's not a vacuum, which means that it's not disconnected from the the weather systems and the ocean circulation patterns of the rest of the world. It's not a separate thing that you can think of separately. It's connected. And that is the same in the case of human activity. Things that influence one part of the region will translate to the Arctic and vice versa. As you mentioned, the next issue is that for some people we joke that most of our installations are at sea level because, you know, that we have Navy ships, and sea level rise is a keen interest item for us. And then the last thing I would say to put it in context for you is that most of the heating we see from the scientists that we work with is in the ocean because of the heat capacity of water. It has more capacity to store energy, as most people are aware from basic science. The ocean has more energy in it than the atmosphere does, and it's storing more heat. And why do people rob banks? Because they go where the money is. That's where the money is. And why do we study the ocean? Me as an oceanographer and my boss, Admiral Titley, as the oceanographer of the Navy, because that's where the heat is. And as the Earth warms, it's the ocean that's the most interesting part of it.
Right. And a couple of questions that I was submitted by some of our groups quite often was, if this has already worked out, you can tell us it's worked out, but in terms of when the Arctic becomes ice-free, what has been resolved or what needs to be resolved regarding borders, mineral rights, et cetera, and what's going to be the role of the Navy in all that?
Well, that's a good question. And that's one of the key things. The third item that you said is our priorities is how the geopolitical nature of the world changes as the climate changes. The basic idea is that we haven't had to worry about it. It's been a boundary to a frontier. The sea ice has been a boundary to that frontier for a long time. And these things are being worked out. Last year, the Norwegians and the Russians had a border dispute in the Arctic north of their territory that they resolved. People would say things like one of the chief areas of potential conflict is this unresolved boundary. But last year, Russia and Norway came to an agreement on this, and it's already been ratified by the equivalent of their Senate. And this is touted by both countries and others as a key sign that success and the strategic objectives and basically the end state of what we see and want in the Arctic, a safe, stable, and secure environment where peaceful cooperation between nations occurs, is the most likely scenario. So there are various disputes in the regions. This is kind of a legal regime that my office doesn't typically get involved with, but we just need to be aware of them. But we stick to that basic line that we need to understand the area better in order to help the diplomats and leaders of these nations work out these differences, just like the Russians and the Norwegians did. But for us, specifically, well, we have to ensure, and this is what Task Force Climate Change is, one of the basic ideas behind it is to ensure that we're prepared as a Navy to operate in the Arctic, because it's an ocean, and we are a global Navy.
Right. And so has that brought about any changes in preparation or thinking in terms of being able to function up there adequately? What kind of changes, if any, has that caused for, you know, everything from kinds of ships, et cetera?
Well, that's a good question. That's exactly what we're doing right now, focusing on that basic question. Essentially, what I can say is that one of the first things we did when the Chief of Naval Operations, the senior naval officer in the U.S. Navy, created Task Force Climate Change, is he directed us to have a plan. And we did that through the development of an Arctic roadmap, which you can find on our website and online just by Googling Navy Arctic Roadmap. And it's a plan of action and milestones, basically, over the next 5 years to understand exactly what we're supposed to do. The first part of that is study and assessment phase. So we did you can see here, I can go through the details if you like. There's a mission analysis. What missions would the Navy perform or not? What's the likelihood that they'll change as the Arctic climate changes and the sea ice opens up and human activity increases in the region? Which missions will be more important? We're doing these capabilities-based assessments, which is essentially looking at what are the gaps in your ability to operate? So we've done one. It'll be released at the end of the summer for the Arctic writ large. We just started a new one because I'm a meteorology oceanography officer. We've kind of known this all along, that one of the biggest gaps, and any physical scientist would know this, the biggest gaps in our understanding capability in the Arctic is knowing how to observe, predict, and map the Arctic environment. And so we've got a group working on the study, including NASA, NOAA, Coast Guard, Air Force, many universities around the country to help us understand and articulate the gaps. And sometimes it's not just Navy. The implications are that no one country in the Arctic, speaking about the Arctic in particular, has the resources or the money to do everything by themselves. In the past, maybe the Coast Guard felt like they could take care of the problem without the Navy involved. Now we understand that, and other nations understand that is not the case anymore. So we work very closely with the Coast Guard. The fundamental reason why is because the Arctic's a challenging environment. It's extremely dangerous. One of the things that the local native population told me, Eskimo Indian population in Alaska, was that people in the lower 48 often have the illusion of knowledge. They think they understand what's going on, but we recognize in our strategic objectives for the Arctic, the Navy's strategic objectives for the Arctic, and working with the State Department, that the people that understand this the best are the people that live there all the time. And that's why he said that's an illusion of knowledge, that you think you know how dangerous the Arctic is. You really don't get it. It's much more dangerous than you think it is, much more hostile to the aircraft and surface vessels operating in that region. That's deadly. And if you're not fully prepared and aware of what the challenges are about to be, because the weather changes much more quickly than it does at the lower latitudes, for example, and these changes are much more drastic and dangerous to people.
And have you been able to get useful advice from the Native Alaskans on how you would adapt?
The Coast Guard is more closely involved with that right now, but at the meeting I was at, they were telling us things like there's more activity up there in certain regions, and they're asking the Coast Guard to work with them to help understand this, and sometimes it interferes with their hunting patterns. Ships may go up there and scare things off or disrupt the ice. It's already thinning. So the ice is by itself is dangerous enough, and if ships go up there, they can make it even worse. That's what they do for survival is hunt. And if you take that away, they don't have anything else. The bottom line is the Navy has time to prepare. The Coast Guard has a more immediate need to deal with the situation. They have 11 statutory missions, so they see it as a very close to home issue. Now, the Navy perceives this as something that we have a little more time to plan for. So we're having two different phased approaches, but we're hip to hip on this.
Right, right. And what about with collaboration with other countries? How closely do you work with other countries on it, what's going to be happening up there?
Very much. I just had a meeting with this past week with the defense attaché officer from Denmark here in D.C., one-star brigadier general, to speak about the Arctic and how we're gonna use Thule Air Base in northwest Greenland. Greenland is a part of the Kingdom of Denmark, so we work with the Danish military for that issue. It's the deepest, it's the most northern deepwater port. It's a 10,000-foot runway. Many of these metrics, by the way, are available in the DoD just recently released a report to Congress on the Arctic, and I was the lead author for Section 2, which is capabilities that the U.S. military has in the Arctic. So I actually went up to Thule and took a lot of notes about what they have and what they don't. So bottom line is there's an agreement that the U.S. can use that. This started in the Cold War in 1951. That's one area where we work with the Canadians and the Danes and the U.S. work together. We think the desire is to work even more closely in the future. We work with the Norwegians, and basically we're having a full-court press on working with the security forces up there, with the Arctic nations and others. Also, we're very closely collaborating with the Coast Guard and the Norwegians to help develop our relationship with Russia, because the U.S. is an Arctic nation because of Alaska. We share a border in the Arctic with Russia between Alaska and the east coast of Russia there in the Bering Strait. So we understand that the future, maintaining fisheries between the boundary of the two countries, monitoring shipping traffic up there. In the past, it's been entirely Coast Guard, essentially. But in the future, we think, because of the limited capabilities, the U.S. has, U.S. Coast Guard has minimal icebreaker capability right now. We're working with them to help understand the implications of that so that we can understand a future operating changes, what they might be, and what the role of Navy might be in assisting them and working up there together.
Okay, cool. All right, well, I promised some of the groups that I would let them ask questions also, so I'm going to start in Anchorage in just a moment, and then we'll go to Seattle, and if there's time, then also Salt Lake City. So first of all, let me just start with Anchorage. Jim up there, you would need to star six your phone to be able to be heard right now. Are you there, Jim?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, please go ahead.
Yeah, one question, I guess sort of a general question is, we've been hearing recently that the effects of global warming are showing up much more rapidly than has been predicted, and certainly we also have known for a long time that the effects are showing up here in Alaska to a greater degree than they are in lower latitudes. In fact, I think just the last couple of days we saw some reports that the sea ice is at its historical low right now. And I wonder if you could just comment on how, in your planning, you are dealing with, or are you or trying to take into account the possibility of fairly accelerated changes here. And is that a problem for your overall planning process?
Well, what I would say is that in every presentation that we give, my admiral, myself, others in this office, we have a section that we talk about wild cards, things that could change the game as we see it. And our task force is a sort of an adaptable leadership. We don't have a static plan because we know that the whole nature has changed. So we have to be able to adjust it. And that particular abrupt climate change is one of the key areas we focus on. Every single presentation is what would happen if this thing accelerated more quickly. We do the best we can to be as proactive as we can in working with others. So we know that we need to monitor the rate of sea ice decline very closely. We need to look at the increase in human activity. So we work closely with the Coast Guard and other nations to understand who's up there and what are they doing, what kind of ships, what kind of adventurers or cruise ships are in the region, and how quickly those are changing. Because big ship, as a naval officer, I understand the implications of big ships in the environment. In that environment, depending on the ship, it can be dirty. And damage the environment even more quickly. So we're very cautious of this and aware of tracking it. And it's also the key, the bottom line in your question is that if this happened, it would be more expensive to adapt more quickly. The implications are that we would be asked to act ahead of the curve we have planned for in our budget. So we would have to figure out a way to, and that's what we do. We look at the military is good at planning for many different possible situations, and that's one of the things we do at our war colleges is learn how to plan from the most likely to the most dangerous possible scenarios. And one of them is if this happens more quickly than we expect. And one of my colleagues at the National Snow and Ice Data Center did one of the studies. Her name is Julianne Strove. She did the study that was in the IPCC report that said that the observations of the sea ice are declining faster than the models are declining. I think that study came out in 07 or 08. So we're very conscious of this. We work very closely with them, and that's one of the things I did at the National Naval Ice Center. By the way, the Navy has known this for a long time. We have symposia on naval operations in an ice-diminished Arctic. We recently had the fourth one in June of this year, but the first one we ever had was in 2001. So I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, I think it did. Good question also, Jim. And let me just check, Ann, does anybody in Seattle, you would have to unmute the phone with star 6. Does anybody there have a question?
Hi, Mark.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So one question we had is, I'm just curious to know how prevalent the concern and understanding of climate change issues is in the Navy as a whole, both among the leadership and the rank and file of the Navy. And we were also curious to know if you all have spoken to Congress.
And given the Congress today, if they get budget cuts, is your research threatened?
Well, we never know exactly where the budget cuts are going to hit us, so I can't really speak into detail in that. Many of my colleagues, many meteorology oceanography officers, work at the Naval Research Labs and the Office of Naval Research because we're basically the scientific officers for the Navy. I can tell you that Admiral Tilley has testified before the Congress 3 times in the last year on climate change. I think it was last week he testified before the Senate subcommittee on commerce and the Coast Guard. He and Ambassador Bolton from State, who's essentially their Arctic lead there, and the Commandant of the Coast Guard testified before the Senate. You can find their testimony online.
How about the House?
Oh, well, yes, that's a good question. He testified before the House twice on climate change, specifically on climate change adaptation. And the last one was the first time he testified before the Senate, and that was on the Arctic specifically. The question about sort of culture that you asked, we work closely with our sister task force in the Navy is Task Force Energy, which I can't speak to in detail, but they deal with alternative fuels and essentially about saving money and finding more efficient ways to operate. They're more closely involved with changing sailors' view on energy conservation and innovative ways to be efficient and sustainability, essentially is the nature of what they do. One of the things we do is refine our ability to help people understand the implications of climate change because I mean, I feel this true. I understand that, because I'm a sailor, that when you are confronted with some of the issues of climate change, it strikes people, and sailors are very upfront about answering this question, and I don't get it. It doesn't seem to relate to me. You're talking about something essentially a million miles away in time, and they don't need to worry about it. They've got something they need to work with today or next week. But climate change is talking about decades away. So they can't quite relate to it at first, and it takes some time to refine our ability to communicate that, to have the sort of story of climate change, like Carl Sagan used to do when he would help people understand cosmology. One of the ways we do that is with risk assessments. To Congress, we do risk assessments on what are the implications of climate change to us. One of the ways we're doing that, for example, is the impact of sea level rise on installations. We're doing a study with that. And our particular aspect of that is refining, ranking each installation, each naval installation by vulnerability. And within each, like number one, number two, number three, most vulnerable installation, we have the components of that installation. The facilities on the installation are ranked in order of vulnerability. So it's a detailed approach to help people understand what's at risk. And one of the ways also that we help people understand climate change is climate change that's happening right now, not in the distant future, that they can't necessarily see. It's not as tangible to them. The thing that is tangible to them is the Arctic. And nobody would argue that it's changing. They can see it. So I've found that one of the most effective ways to get people to realize this is the Arctic, and I often tell even my own colleagues that everything I'm doing in the Arctic is a regional thing, but it's the same thing. It's just more proximate in time. It's happening right now. In the future, this will happen elsewhere. The only difference is, of course, that it's icy, and they don't have to worry about that as much in the rest of the globe, but the fundamental physics is essentially the same.
Okay, very good. Okay, Dave in Salt Lake City, does someone there have a question that you wanted to ask of Commander McBride?
Sure, my name is Sam.
Can you get a little bit closer to the mic, please, Sam?
My question is, how much do you think about the melting of Greenland ice, glaciers and so forth in relation to influencing the North Atlantic conveyor belt? There used to be a lot of talk about that in climate science and not so much anymore. So I'm curious what you think.
That's certainly a possibility. I learned about this connection in when I was getting my first master's degree in physical oceanography in the late 1990s. And then I was, you know, everybody joked that this movie The Day After Tomorrow came out, and that was one of the underlying themes. And I thought, oh, the cat was out of the bag. I thought I knew something special, but now everybody knows this connection, potential for the connection of the thermal haline circulation of the planet in the oceans. And the idea is that as water moves across the transpolar drift stream across the Arctic, it goes into the Fram Strait and melts, and it's more fresh than the regular seawater. And that the Gulf Stream comes up and sinks down when it gets colder. Well, the fresh water might interfere with its ability to sink down. The runoff from Greenland is a part of that, but the primary reason the runoff of Greenland is a concern is that that's where the huge ice sheet is, and that's where the sea level rise could come from most dramatically in the future, next century. Right now, there's not that much data on it, so many of the scientists that are studying the Greenland ice cap actually go via Thule. There was a thing recently that I helped some of the Naval Academy folks go up there with NASA. You know, they have something called an ice bridge that they were studying the ice cap on Greenland. It's a way that the scientists connect Greenland ice cap through Thule Air Base. And there's a lot more science to go into here, but it's essentially the way we talk about it when briefing it writ large, because, you know, somebody that's not or less convinced or maybe a doubter would say, well, the sea ice melt doesn't raise sea level because it doesn't overflow my glass of iced tea when it melts either. But that's true, but that's not the point. The point of the sea ice extent on the water is the human activity and other thermodynamic changes in the region, albedo effect and so on, reflectivity of the sunlight there and increasing heating. But for the Greenland is not over water, and that when that ice does melt and go into the ocean, it will cause sea level to rise, and that is what we're really focusing quite a bit. There's something that NASA has called a GRACE satellite, and it uses gravimetric measurements to study the change in the density of the Greenland ice cap, so we can have a better understanding of the rate at which the Greenland ice cap is melting. Now, the thermal haline circulation and the what you're talking about is related to that, but it's for Greenland specifically, it's mostly about sea level rise over the next century.
Great, thank you. So, Commander McBride, that time went way too quickly. We really appreciate you making yourself available. You are more than welcome to stick on the call. I know you're busy, and to even ask you for part of your Saturday, we're really, really grateful. But thank you so much. That was extremely useful, and we're really, really pleased that you could be on the call today.
It's a pleasure. And if you would, to help people understand it a little bit better, get some references on the Internet, I'll send you in my email. I'll send you the link to our Green Fleet website.
Right.
We also have a Facebook website where you can get access to some of the studies we have and roadmaps, so you can see for yourself what we're doing.
Great. Thank you so much, and thank you for your service.
It's a pleasure and an honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Well, that was cool. All right, so we're going to get on to the second and then the third part of the call. The next thing we want to do now is get reports from the field of what's happened since last month's call. I'm going to turn the call over to Judy, who's covering for Amy today, in just a moment. The one thing that I want to mention before I hand it off to Judy is I think the most common complaint I get from people is, why isn't everybody working together on this issue? And usually with respect to that question is really the environmental organizations. There are obviously a lot more people who are way interested, like the military, But the question that I usually get asked is, why aren't all the environmental organizations working together? And I usually give people what I consider a somewhat glib answer to that, which is, it would be really easy to do that except for there are people involved. And as everybody knows, anytime you're working with people, certain things come to bear that would be much simpler if there weren't people, but we have to solve this with people. Well, that being said, 2 weeks ago, we participated in a day-and-a-half program with 51 environmental organizations to get everybody in a room to sit down and see if we could all get on the same page with respect to pricing carbon. And we didn't get everything worked out, but we have 4 working groups coming from it. But I just want to give you a feel of the 51 organizations who were there. That included Friends of the Earth, the Union of Concerned Scientists, Chesapeake Climate Action Network, the Sierra Club, Republicans for Environmental Protection, the Environmental Defense Fund, the Union of Concerned Scientists, the NAACP, Future 500, the World Wildlife Fund, National Wildlife Federation, Rockefeller Family Fund, and the Center for American Progress. So it was a very healthy discussion. At least we had everybody in a room talking together about how we can solve this and what is the most effective mechanism for pricing carbon. There are 4 working groups, and we'll keep you apprised of what happens with that. But I thought that was a huge step forward, because I have been in that group of people who said we should have everybody working together and a little bit fretting about how hard it was. But nevertheless, we got everybody in one room and made some real progress. Okay, Judy, are you there? Judy in Encinitas, can you unmute your phone? Just go ahead and *6 it. Judy?
Can you hear me now?
Loud and clear now. Go ahead, Judy.
Okay, we have a little mute *6 issue at this end. Okay,
right.
First, before I start, for those of you who have not heard this before, LTE stands for letter to the editor. So I'm going to start with us in San Diego North County. We had 2 LTEs in the Californian. The La Jolla group met with the military support group Project Free. They also had 6 comments published out of 106 for California's AB 32, that's an assembly bill to limit greenhouse gases. In Tallahassee, Florida, there was 1 LTE. In the Tallahassee Democrat, 1 staff column in the Tallahassee Democrat, and 23 million letter march letters. In Atlanta, Georgia, an LTE in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and an article in Huffington Post. In Cedar Rapids, Iowa, there was an editorial board meeting with the Gazette and an editorial printed. In Boston, CCL gave a presentation at the Cambridge Somerville for Change and had an article in the Patriot Ledger. In Alexandria, Minnesota, there were editorial board meetings with the Echo Press in Alexandria, the Fergus Falls paper, and the St. Cloud newspaper, an article in the Richfield Patch, a letter to the editor regarding fracking in the Red Wing News. And from Minneapolis, there was an article in the Parker's Prairie Independent. In East Windsor, New Jersey, 1 letter to the editor, and Joseph Robertson gave a presentation on the green economy. In Red Bank, New Jersey, face-to-face meeting with Representative Allison Schwartz. In Norman, Oklahoma, the group met with the editor of the Norman, Oklahoma Transcript. In Salt Lake City, Utah, the group spoke with Representative Matheson and met with the editorial board at the Deseret News. There was 1 op-ed in the Ogden Standard Examiner and an op-ed in the city in the Deseret News. 3 LTEs and 23 million letter march letters. In Richmond, Virginia, there were 6 LTEs printed, including 1 from Mills in Washington, D.C. There were 2 editorial articles, 1 op-ed, 40 million letter march letters, and CCL partners attended the Republicans for Environmental Protection event. In Seattle, Washington, there was an LTE that we just found out was printed in April, and 24 million letter march postcards at SolarFest. There in Madison, Wisconsin, we just found out about 2 LTEs published in June and 10 million letter march letters. 2 LTEs in July in the Wisconsin State Journal and Kenosha News, an editorial board meeting with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And I know there were more million letter march letters from Minnesota that I forgot to mention, and I don't have the exact number. Finally, in Canada, there was LTE in the National Globe and Mail, a meeting with MP Matthew Kelway and an MPP Peter Tabbins. That was in Toronto, and in Sudbury, Canada, the group has contacted Senator Mitchell regarding the Climate Change Accountability Act and contacted a member of Parliament, met with the Climate Action Network regarding Lobby Week in Ottawa, received a grant for $1,500 from Big Sisters Brothers, and CCL was published 3 times. That's it.
Great. Great. Really nice. Very succinct, Judy. We might have to cut Amy's pay on this and increase yours. All right, very good. I want to emphasize a couple of things that happened this month also. Ellie Whitney, are you there from New Jersey? Can you unmute your phone? *6, please. Go ahead and try that again. See if we can *6 you, Ellie Whitney. Are you there, Ellie? Okay, we'll come back to you in a second. What about Bill Farrell in Iowa City? Are you there, Bill?
Ellie Whitney here.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead, Ellie Whitney. So, Ellie, could you just report a little bit about, you had a talk that you sponsored, that you put on, you invited the people. Could you just say a little bit about what happened to that talk and the impression of the people who attended?
It was a great talk. It was the talk by Joseph Robertson, who is the coordinator of the New Jersey Citizens Climate Lobby Group. And he wrote the book that TL makes available that's called Greening the Economy or something like that, Building a Green Economy. And he spoke essentially giving an outline of that book. This audience has attended probably, it was about 35 adults, very interested in all aspects of climate change and legislation. And they've learned a lot about it. They've had perhaps attended maybe 5 different previous talks. The missing piece was once we have put a price on carbon and shifted the economy towards alternative energy, then what happens? What's ready to go? What can we do with alternative energy? And Joe spoke for an hour on that subject. All of the women in the audience fell in love with him because he's very handsome. And but aside from that, everyone also was very impressed with what he had to say. And just one comment at the end of his talk was, oh my God, I had no idea. This really gives me hope. So it was great.
Great, great. Thanks for reporting on that. Thanks for putting it on. And I think it's an important piece that we're going to have to have Joe train the rest of us on, is training people on, here's how we can go to wind, solar, geothermal, here's how it'll succeed, here's what we'll do it. So thanks for putting that on, Ellie, and I think it was good to get that out road tested so we can spread it around the country. Thank you,
yes,
thank you, Ellie, and thank you, Joe.
Lorman has 2 more things to report. We have 2 commentaries from Dr. Kessler, who is the former director of the National Severe Storms Lab in the local paper Opinions, and Mary Frances is going to do civil disobedience at the tar sands action. And a question, does the 51 organizations include the 350.org group, that's a huge group?
350 was planned on attending, and they were not able to make it, but almost every other major environmental organization was there. But thank you for the clarification on that. Appreciate it. Great. Okay, Bill Farrell, are you there from Iowa City? Bill, if you're there, go ahead and unmute your phone.
Mark, you there?
Okay. Yeah, Bill, please. So this is, you're there, Bill, is that you?
I am.
Okay, great. So we started 2 groups back in Iowa a couple of weeks ago in Iowa City and Cedar Rapids. There were 33 people in the room. It was just an amazing group of people. I think everybody on this call is going to be thrilled to have them as allies. You know, it's great any time that we start new groups, but there are a couple of things were really fantastic about Iowa. One is, having groups in Iowa gives us a chance to influence the Iowa caucuses. That's huge. And the other thing is, the day before we started the groups, we had a meeting with the entire editorial board of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. And Bill was one of the people at that meeting, and the paper actually wrote an article the day of the meeting. So, Bill, could you go ahead and share that article with us?
Absolutely. That was it was a real great event, and great to see their reactions from that. This article was by Todd Dorman of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Titled, Government Taxes Carbon, money goes to households. Some folks from the Citizens Climate Lobby stopped in this morning to tell our editorial board about two new chapters of the group being formed in Cedar Rapids and Iowa City. The CCL is building a network of local groups with hopes that these local voices will have a better chance of catching the attention of individual members of Congress. The group believes climate change is happening, that the scientific consensus points to man-made causes, and that federal action is needed to address it. Executive Director Mark Reynolds outlined what CCL thinks the action should look like. I'm no expert on this stuff. I'm just a typical carbon burner, but I thought it was an interesting idea, so I'm throwing it out there. Basically, the federal government would place a $15 per ton tax on CO2 emissions charged at the mine, rig, or other facility where commodities enter the economy. The tax would go up to $10 per ton each year. Here's the intriguing part. Every dime raised by the tax would be rebated to the Americans to offset any increases in energy costs caused by the tax. Reynolds claims that 70% of households would see bigger dividend checks than rate increases. The government would pretty much wipe out all other energy subsidies, and goods coming from overseas from countries without a carbon tax would be assessed a fee to level out any cost advantage. Reynolds contends the rising carbon tax would send a clear signal to budding entrepreneurs that their alternative energy ventures will eventually be competitive and profitable alongside traditional energy sources. Investors would like that certainty. The side, of course, is that coal and, to a lesser extent, oil would be the biggest losers under this scenario. This sounds a lot less complex than cap and trade, which is pretty much dead and buried. Maybe in this political climate, this idea is also dead. My first thought about this stuff like this is that it can't possibly be this simple. But it's worth chewing over. Here's CCL's proposed legislation in more detail.
Great, Bill. Really nicely done. Thank you so much. And just so everybody can, I think, can assume with that, is in addition to that article, they include our draft legislation with the language of with their article. So that was a pretty nice way to get those groups started. Okay, so one last thing I want to emphasize in terms of reports from the field, and then I'll have Steve Trainers on our laser talks. So here are some of the cities and newspapers that we have now met with the editorial board. The Boston Globe, the North County Times in San Diego, the Salt Lake City Tribune, and the Deseret News in Salt Lake City. So two papers in Salt Lake City, nice work, Salt Lake City Group. The Richmond Times-Dispatch, the Rapid City Gazette, the Norman Transcript, three papers in Minnesota. Amazing work, Alexandria, Minnesota. So that's the Alexandria, Minnesota Echo Press, the Fergus Falls Daily Journal, and the St. Cloud Times, the Tallahassee Democrat, and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel just last week. And then one final coup with that is last week we got confirmation that this month we have a meeting with the Washington Post. I don't think that there's any more influential newspaper other than the New York Times for us to be able to get an editorial board meeting with. So the thing that I want to say with those cities where we have not had meetings yet, let's keep asking for those meetings. Every single one of these meetings happened because somebody called the paper up and said, I want to meet with your editorial board. The least number of articles we've gotten from these so far is one, and in one case we've gotten more than 15. And kind of the leader on this has been Richmond, which has been doing a fantastic job of staying connected to the paper. The Richmond paper has generally advocated conservative positions on their editorial page, and this month they've gone so far to ask for Republicans to take leadership to create a go-to-the-moon type project regarding renewable energies and that we should put a tax on fossil fuel. So this is one area where the return on investment of our time is so much that we want to keep focusing on it, but it is just a phenomenal job that all UCCL volunteers have done 12 editorial board meetings. There's more scheduled coming up, and it is just amazing what you're doing. Okay, Steve Falk, are you out there and ready to train us on this month's Laser Talk for Canada and the Laser Talk for the U.S.?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Great, great, super. So this month's Laser Talks, we're going to focus on the economic aspect of moving toward the green economy by putting a price on carbon. So we'll start off with the Canadian Laser Talk, and here it is. what's good for the Earth's climate, it turns out, can also be good for cancer.
Steve, we can't hear you in Salt Lake City. Can you talk up, please?
I'm speaking right into the...
Just speak a little louder, Steve.
Okay, I'll speak as loud as I can. What's good for the Earth's climate, it turns out, can also be good for Canada's economy. The green economy, according to a report from Citizens Climate Lobby, can produce 2 to 3 times the number of jobs for the same amount of investment in the brown economy of fossil fuels. The quickest way to expand the green economy and the jobs that come with it is by putting a price on carbon that moves us away from fossil fuels. Despite warnings of economic disaster, there are ways to price carbon that will help rather than hinder the economy. The carbon tax in British Columbia is a prime example. The province initiated a levy of $10 per ton of CO2 emissions in 2008, increasing by $5 each year. Revenue from tax is recycled back to individuals and businesses in the form of lower income taxes. Since 2008, per capita fuel use has dropped 4.5%, more than elsewhere in Canada. Unemployment is slightly below the national average, and growth is slightly higher. Meanwhile, over in Ontario, the Green Energy Act is clearing the air and creating jobs. The feed-in tariff provision of the new law has attracted billions of dollars in new investment. The Act has already created 13,000 clean energy jobs, and the province expects it to create 50,000 new jobs by the end of 2010. It's been demonstrated that incentives for clean energy will produce jobs. Putting a nationwide fee on carbon and returning the revenue to households will produce the jobs that Canadians need and make our nation a global leader in green technology. So that's the talk for Canada. Shifting over to the U.S., again, we're focused on the economy. And I really want to emphasize, you know, that right now particularly, that this is a context that we really need to be focusing on. Yesterday's numbers for employment were very dismal. There's a lot of people who fear we might be slipping back into another recession. And so for us to approach this from the aspect of, this is a sector that will grow the economy and create jobs. I think this is a very opportune moment for us to be talking about it like this. So now, in this particular laser talk, I sent out last night a revised version. So please make sure that the latest version of the talk it clarifies the distinction between the green economy and the clean tech sector. But here's the laser talk for the U.S. The discussion in Washington has been dominated by extremists. The vast majority of Americans in the center feel frustrated and left out of the conversation. They are frustrated particularly because our government is immobilized at a time when our economy is weak and Americans need jobs. One of the few bright spots in our economy has been the growth in the green sector of clean energy and energy efficiency. A recent report from the Brookings Institution finds that clean tech jobs in the green sector now number 2.7 million. The median salary for those jobs is nearly 20% higher than the national average. The annual rate of growth for the clean tech sector, wind, solar, and other emerging technologies, was almost twice the rate of growth for other jobs. The Brookings report also recommends putting a price on carbon in order to maximize the job potential in the green sector. Other studies have found that investments in the green sector produce far more jobs than investments in fossil fuels. A price on carbon would shift investments from fossil fuels to clean energy. For the good of our economy and to produce more jobs, Congress needs to enact a pricing mechanism on carbon that both sides can live with. Such a solution exists with carbon fee and dividend, which puts a steadily increasing fee on carbon-based fuels and returns the revenue from that fee to all households. With a clear price signal in place, government can step aside and allow private investments to be the driving force in the transition to a green economy and the good-paying jobs that come with it. So there you go. There's our two laser talks.
Okay. Steve, thank you so much. Really nice. Very, very clear. Appreciate that very much. Okay, so there's a couple things that we're asking everybody to do this month. So we're asking all Canadian and U.S. groups, given the members of Parliament and Congress are on recess, to ask for face-to-face time while they're in the district or riding. So we're asking that every group ask for face-to-face times with your members of Parliament or Congress. The second thing, then, is we're asking everybody to write one letter today. In the Canadian groups, we're asking you to write a letter to your member of Parliament using the laser talk as the basis of what you're asking your member of Parliament to do. In the U.S., we're asking for a little bit of a different action. Judy mentioned that one of the actions that happened this month is some of our people from Washington, D.C. and Richmond attended a talk put on by Republicans for the Environment. And John Huntsman, who was one of the Republican candidates, spoke. He spoke about the need of dealing with the science of climate change. And so we're asking all U.S. volunteers this month to write a letter to Mr. Huntsman. His address is on the action sheet, thanking him for speaking up on science and suggesting that we have a solution that has a bipartisan it's bipartisan. So anyway, we're asking everybody to write one letter before you leave today. In U.S. to Mr. Huntsman, in Canada to your member of Parliament, and we're asking all groups to ask for face-to-face time with your member of Congress or Parliament during the August recess. Okay, the other thing always is please do practice the laser talk while you're there. One new twist is this month. We're going to ask that rather than at the end of this call, everybody reporting how many people are in the room and how many letters or meetings you're going to ask for, Steve Balk's email address is at the bottom of the action sheet. If you would just go ahead and email that to Steve, that would be really great. Marshall's reaction to last month's call when we tried to get everybody to call in their numbers and their city at the end of the call was that we need to have a conference call in the future dedicated to just to how people mute and unmute the phone. Well, we're not going to do that, so we're going to try a little bit different angle for how we're going to get the results. Last thing I want to leave you with today is we never try and fight with Labor Day, so our September call will be the second Saturday in September. The speaker is going to be Tony Lazarowicz from Yale. Mr. Lazarowicz is the gentleman who's one of the co-authors of the study that many of you have read called The Six Americas, that talks where different categories of North Americans are with respect to climate change and how you can move them up the ladder of dealing with moving them along so that we're getting everybody dealing with it. The October speaker is Mark Jacobson from Stanford. Mr. Jacobson and a colleague have put together a paper where they've actually documented where every wind pattern in the world is so that they have actually mapped the world so we know every place that we would need solar panels or wind turbines to completely transition to renewable energy within 20 years. So we're excited about both those. We're really grateful that Commander McBride could be on today. Thank you all for all you're doing, and we'll talk to you again in the call in September. Thanks, everybody. Have a great month.